Do you invest in ETFs? Whether you're thinking, what in the world is an ETF? Or you're looking for the next opportunity to add to your portfolio. GlobalX has you covered. From big tech to bonds and bars of gold, GlobalX offers a wide range of exchange-traded funds. Go beyond ordinary with GlobalX ETFs. Visit globalxetfs.com.au. That's globalxetfs.com.au.
I am so excited to tell you that InvestSmart and Intelligent Investor are long-term sponsors of this podcast. And here's something I want to tell you about. The Intelligent Investor Select Value Fund is a unique mix of global leaders and homegrown small caps poised for long-term growth. The portfolio manager is Nathan Bell, a talented investor you have heard on the RAS network many times. The Select Value Fund is designed for investors seeking international diversification and Aussie companies with superior financial metrics. You can invest today at intelligentinvestor.com.au. That's intelligentinvestor.com.au.
Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes. Luke, welcome back to the Australian Investors Podcast.
Thanks for having me on again, Owen.
Yeah, second time around, mate. Well, Raymond interviewed you the first time.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you come away feeling from that interview?
I really enjoyed it. That was actually the first podcast recording that I'd done. Had a good time just chatting with Raymond. I enjoy chatting with anyone generally about investing. So the ability to turn the mic on as well, bit of fun. So
yeah, for sure it is. We've got a bit of, if you can hear some noise in the background, we are recording from Noosa, the Inside Network event. We've got a lot of consultants, advisors, portfolio managers here talking about all different types of things. So we thought we'd take a moment just to chat about some of your lessons learned, but also some companies. So mm-hmm. I'm hoping you can really bring some actionable examples, because obviously, you know, I think your Twitter bio says Aussie large caps by day, small caps by night.
Yep.
I think that's what it says. So you eat, sleep, and breathe this stuff, and you're kind of exposed to a lot of companies that a lot of our community would be exposed to.
Yes.
And I just hope that we can use some of those examples. Like, we're talking about this last night when we caught up, about different businesses, about different people, and how that the questions you ask and things like that. So why don't we just start off with, if people haven't listened to that first episode, I know Buffett was brought up a bit. Not going to lie, he was in there quite a bit, but it was good. It was a great interview, and I'll put a link in the show notes. Tell us a bit about how you invest, just from like a top-down perspective, how you think about the world of investing and business.
So how I approach investing, both at work and personally, is looking for those quality companies, companies that are going to compound their earnings over time for many years to come, and trying my best to pay what I view as a fair valuation. And anyone that has read anything about Warren Buffett will recognize that instantly, because that's more or less what he tries to do. And so it is very difficult to talk about investing in my approach without talking about Uncle Warren. And so maybe to just define that a little bit more, is looking for companies with an economic moat or a competitive advantage. Mm-hmm. And that can come in many forms. It could be a strong brand. It could be low costs. It could be a network effect, like your social media or some social media platforms, as an example. And basically all that allows those companies generally to be able to increase their prices well above inflation, and be able to charge what they like for their product without losing customers.
I know that you've got some great examples in on the website, which we'll get to in a little bit, but you mentioned something there. If I can just cut you off real quick. You mentioned like paying a reasonable price. Yes. How do you determine that? How are you, like, what methods are you using to determine value?
So we do use a few methods. My preference is generally, wherever possible, to use a discounted cash flow,
okay,
because that's what the market uses.
Yeah.
And some people will disagree with me there, but my view is that to come up with today's market price of any stock, the market in aggregate is forecasting out the cash flows of a business out into the future for any length of time. And that's a different conversation, but the market is forecasting the cash flows and then discounting those back into the present value terms. Mm. And so that's what I try and do. I come up with my own estimates, and I forecast earnings and cash flows out into the future, come up with a discount rate, which is another conversation again, and use that to come up with a valuation. So that's probably the first one. I'll also use multiples, as well as sometimes a sanity check, or maybe a quick and dirty method of trying to work out where a company is. I might start there, and if it looks cheap, I'll then do maybe a DCF afterwards.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to jump in here again. You mentioned there that you determine a discount rate.
Yep.
This is very contentious part of, I think I'm jumping ahead of us a bit here, because I know we want to talk about this towards the back end of the show. But how do you think about determining a discount rate? Like, what inputs go into that?
Yeah, so without diving into the like textbooks, we use what's called the like capital asset pricing model, which essentially looks at you start with a risk-free rate. Mm-hmm. So what's a 10-year government bond yielding at the moment? 3.5-4%. That's what you can get for free, as basically, or yep, without taking on any risk, rather. And so to invest in stocks, you're going to have to take on more risk. And what do you need to be paid for that, basically? So you look at, okay, what's the market yielding? Or what's implied in that? And you sort of more or less add that on. So you got your risk-free rate, and then what do I need to be paid to take on that additional risk? That becomes your discount rate. And there's a few other inputs there, but very simply, that's your starting point. And it does move around, but it can be anywhere between maybe 8% up to 15%, depending on the that particular kind of business and how volatile it might be.
Do you ever do sensitivity analysis or any type of thing around that, where you measure the sensitivity of your valuations, or do you do scenario analysis, if I can get that out correctly, where you might have a range of valuations, or are you looking for like a point in time, this is like, give or take, this is my valuation?
Yeah, I do prefer to come up with a range, because valuations are all estimates. And so it's almost a bit arrogant to say, okay, that my valuation for whatever stock is $3.51. That's what it's worth. Mm. To answer your question, like, yes, I think it is good practice to actually say, well, here's maybe a bear case, here's a bull case, and here's a base case. And you can assign weightings based on changing various things. And you generally, I'll keep that discount rate constant, and I'll fiddle with the earnings.
Mm.
So I'll say, oh, in a best case scenario, they'll be able to do X, Y, and Z. But in a worst case scenario, they might actually go backwards.
Yeah, I like that, because that's where a lot of people struggle with, particularly if they're newer investors and they're newer to value investing as a like an art and a science. They often wonder, well, hey, my valuation's way off. Maybe I'll just tinker with the discount rate, right? But that kind of, I think that maybe detracts from the skill of investing. Whereas you're saying it's more the earnings that can be adjusted from there. Okay, so I've gone way off track here, Luke. but fascinated by that conversation. One of the things that I wanted to talk to you about, and this is more like kind of like pie in the sky, let's look at the top down. I know you're a bottom up type guy. Mm-hmm. You love fundamentals. We just talked about valuation and so on and so forth. A lot of talk, you know, we've seen some volatility recently. I know you've got a couple of names in the portfolio. You've got, as of the date of recording, Altium, which is a technology company, right?
Yeah.
Got other businesses in here that, you know, have been subject to quite a bit of volatility lately. So I guess I'm just trying to get a sense of where you see the investing landscape now. However you want to take this question, maybe it could be in contrast to times gone by. And then maybe we can just dive into it from there.
Yeah, sure. So you mentioned where we are bottom-up investors, and that certainly is our core.
Yep.
We do try and overlay a macro backdrop to that as well. So
okay.
We'll study the businesses, and we'll that's certainly where we'll start there. But then we'll also study the economy, what's happening in Australia, what's happening in the US and overseas. And we'll research that as well. And that is also presented to the team as well, which feeds into there. And depending on what we're seeing there, we will tinker with sector weightings and allocations to particular types of businesses. So, for example, we have been reducing names like your Altiums, which are higher growth, probably higher risk in this sort of environment, seeing those discount rates or those risk-free rates changing.
Mm.
And so they are a little bit higher risk at the moment. So, yeah, we still do own companies like Altium. That's certainly still in the portfolio, but that the exposure to those has been decreasing over through 2022.
Mm. How about do you have any hard and fast rules around, so you mentioned that macro feeds into asset allocation basically for the portfolio. Do you have any sector limits or position limits in the portfolio? So do you ever have I speak to some investors who are 20 stocks maximum, 10 stocks is what we aim for. Do you have anything like that feeds in?
Yeah. So on a product mandate sort of level, if you want to talk there, so it's between 20 and 50 name, so plenty of breadth. Typically where we sit around 35 to 40, we find that that's enough diversification to be properly diversified without just getting a market return.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of individual names, it's 5% above the benchmark weight.
Okay.
For example, in the large cap Aussie portfolio, you've got some constituents that are already above 5%, like BHP, CSL,
yep.
They're already in your sixes and sevens and eights. So we could go up to 11%, say, for those. But typically, we don't. Generally, we keep within much lower than that.
And does the portfolio? Because I'm looking at the top 10 holdings, right? And BHP isn't in there, CSL isn't in there, the big banks aren't in there as far as I can tell right now. And we're recording this in early October 2022. Do you find that you're getting a mid-cap bias, you're skewing the portfolio towards a bit more growth?
No, it's certainly skewed towards growth, yes. I don't think it's skewed towards the mid-cap. So the large cap, the Australian equities portfolio, which you're talking about, it is only a top 100 or an ASX 100 portfolio. So mm-hmm. Even towards the lower end of there, you're probably getting into your mid-caps, but they're all well and truly large caps in that portfolio or in that index as well.
Yeah. The one thing that I like to ask, Luke, for bottom-up investors like myself, so to have you on the show, it's a treat, is basically companies that have taught you investing lessons. I had some analysts on the show not so long ago who talked about the different businesses that they've owned over the past 5 to 10 years and how that's informed their approach to other companies and their process. Because I find we can get, an investing checklist off the shelf, Buffett's got his 5 criteria, but then we find, I've found the longer investors go that they can kind of make it their own. So do you have any examples? When I sent you the questions, I asked for three companies. You don't have to have three necessarily, but some companies that have taught you those investing lessons that have helped you then grow as an investor.
Yeah, sure. So the biggest lessons I find generally come from your biggest losses or in some cases, what you've missed out on. So the first one that I thought taught me several lessons over a period of a few years was Afterpay, which the company, the company or the business is probably not news to most people listening out there. But I came across Afterpay pretty early back when it was back before it actually merged with TouchCorp, which is going back maybe 5 or 6 years now. So how the story goes is, Afterpay was spun out of TouchCorp with a few guys that were working there at the time, who then became the CEOs. But TouchCorp retained 30% of Afterpay, and Afterpay grew so strongly, even in those early days. I think it grew from $1 to $2.50 or something, that Afterpay on the balance sheet of TouchCorp, the value was worth more than the TouchCorp shares itself. So you could have bought shares in TouchCorp and basically got the Afterpay shares for free. And so I didn't end up acting on that. And basically what that taught me was you should back yourself, because you found this this thing that probably not many people were looking at the time. And yeah, then it got to what, $160.
Well, why did you remember why you said no? Was it just, did you just doubt that this was like too good to be true, or?
Yeah, I think I started to think about the valuation of Afterpay too much.
Okay.
And thought, okay, well, that what the market's ascribing to that in that section of Afterpay that TouchCorp owns, as soon as Afterpay goes back to a dollar, then you're back to square one. And in the end, that's not what happened, clearly.
Yep.
And
sometimes that could happen though, right? Like if you look through a portfolio, like say Washington Soul Pattinson is a good example of this, because they own Chuas, they own, you know, New Hope, Brickworks, all that sort of stuff. And those are publicly listed companies inside of Brickworks, inside of Soul Patts. So that could happen.
Yes.
So that's, it's probably more like the conservative side. Like you realize that could happen. It just happens that this one went on and 150x. So that happens. But that's a really good example. And so having the conviction to back yourself. So did you bring three companies to the table?
I did actually.
Okay, cool.
Let's do it. The next one is a little company that is no longer listed called RXP Services. RXP. So they were basically a IT body shop. They had contractors they would send out to big companies like NAB and Telstra and other companies like that, and they would do, it's basically outsourced building of their apps and IT things like that that the companies like NAB just didn't want to do themselves. And so it was an okay business, but it was a roll-up.
Okay.
And they did fine. They went from, I can't remember what they listed, I think I got shares at 55 cents. They went up to $1.20, which was great. And then they went down to 30 cents. And I think I got out at about 55 cents after a few years. And so
about break even.
About break even, yeah. I didn't lose money, but didn't make money on them. But I probably learned two lessons there is roll-ups are great until they're not.
Yep.
So there comes a point in every roll-up. And for those that don't know what a roll-up is, it's basically it's a listed company going around buying private companies and getting a valuation arbitrage. So that's great. That feeds into the company stock price and it increases over time, which is great. And then they run out of things to buy. And then that high multiple that the stock has been priced on is no longer worth it anymore because there's nothing more to buy, there's no more growth, and now it's this business which is probably still an okay business, but there's no growth because they've only grown by by acquisition. The other lesson that I learned from RXP is just because it's cheap is not a good enough reason to hold on to it or even to buy it. So the stock ran all the way up to, I think it was $1.20 from memory, and it was still an 8x. So
you thought maybe it could go higher?
Yeah, well, I thought, maybe it should be trading on 12x or 13x, but 8x just seems too cheap. I'm going to hold. And then it fell. Yeah, it unwound. That's right. And so in the end, yeah.
Do you think, though, that – so do you think, like, one of the lessons there is because it was a lower quality company, your expectations were too high?
Yeah, I think that's probably right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the lesson maybe is then, like, just understand the quality of the company when making that assessment of earnings. Yeah. Okay. That's a good one. I did hear about it because I feel like it was a popular company amongst microcap investors. Not one that I ever looked at, probably should have. What's number three?
Okay. The third one, company everyone's probably heard of, is BHP.
Okay. Yeah. So, I think I've heard of it. Yeah.
I gave that nice little spiel at the top about the type of companies we look for and companies with pricing power and an economic moat and whatever else. Commodities generally don't fit that profile. And so it's BHP as a business is not one that generally meets a lot of our criteria or my criteria personally as an investor. And anyone that's seen the iron ore price in the last year or so, or even the share price of BHP, it's had a phenomenal run. And what that's taught me is some businesses don't fit into your neat little valuation mindset, but they need to be analysed differently. And so BHP as a company, it is a really low cost producer. So being the size that they are, they can pull the iron ore out of the ground at about $14 a ton, and then they were selling it for $120. I think there's a margin in there somewhere.
Yeah.
And so the way to think about BHP is, and all commodity producers for that matter, I just pick BHP as the biggest and the hairiest. The way to think about that is that as a cyclical. So watch the cycles, watch the economic cycle and the iron ore cycle. It's sort of clear when it's the top and it's sort of clear when it's the bottom. Like a few years ago, might have been 2016, they were at $8, and people in the media were actually contemplating, oh, is BHP actually going to go bust?
I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the end, they didn't even go close, and then they got to well over 50 not that long ago. It's come back a little bit now with the iron ore price.
Huge dividends along the way.
Huge dividends, that's right.
So, yeah, right, I like it. So, I think this is a struggle that I've had throughout my time investing too, to be honest, is how, like, a set framework. Like, we kind of get values given to us when we read or we learn from other investors or even indeed listen to podcasts. Like, for example, Buffett never invested in gold. So, well, if he doesn't do it, then I shouldn't do it, right? And we can become a bit, I guess, this is our line in the sand, and then I don't step over that side because this guy said don't do it, you know? So for you to say that, then let's, like, talk about a different framework for that. I think that's really important to have that mental flexibility as well.
That's right.
Yeah. So we've gone from three companies that have taught you lessons. And now I'm going to ask you to be a bit more forward-looking, Logan. Can you, as we record this, maybe think about three business models or businesses that are really interesting to you right now?
Yeah, I probably haven't thought too far out of the box in trying to answer
Sometimes
this question.
Best.
Sometimes it is. So at the moment in the current economic climate, I still really like enterprise SaaS businesses. Yep. So businesses that are fairly entrenched in business workflows that have that recurring revenue, that even though the economy might be going through a bit of a rough patch right now or in the coming future, that they're still going to be able to earn that recurring revenue. Mm. And yes, their growth might be lower because it might be a little bit more difficult to onboard the next customer. But the customers that they have will hang on. So two examples that come to mind would be like a Xero.
Yep.
That's your accounting software. It doesn't matter what the economy is doing. That's probably the last expense that you're going to cut.
Yeah. We're talking to someone last night about Xero.
Yes, we
and
were.
They were like, now I don't see this changing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. And then another one is probably Adobe again.
Yep.
If you work for a creative agency, that's the last expense that you're going to cut because you can't do any work without Photoshop or Premiere or whatever it happens to be, whatever that project is. Unless you're going out of business, you're going to pay that subscription.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that. It's a really good example. They did buy Figma recently for $20 billion. Do you have any views on that?
Yeah, I do. I still don't mind it. I think the market's probably overreacted a little bit to that acquisition. They're probably overpaying a bit. I mean, 50 times recurring revenue is up there.
yeah. It's on $20 billion price tag. It's So Figma's a good program, though.
Yeah.
Having used it, I think it's great.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think it'll do a great thing for Adobe. Like they're obviously it's fairly early in the Figma journey, which they're paying for a lot of that future, and they will be able to utilize a lot of the technology that Figma has used and deploy that across their own suite. So in some sense, I think it's Adobe saying we've missed the boat a little bit here, and that they're having to pay for that. But I think they will be able to benefit from it.
Mm. I like it. So that's the model is SaaS.
Yep.
Have you got any others for us?
Yeah. So another one is retailers, but retailers with a strong brand.
Interesting.
So there's plenty of retailers that are listed, but it's the ones with a strong brand that are most interested at the moment. So I did pull out a couple of examples.
Yeah.
Nick Scali was one.
Yep.
Very quality products, as far as I can tell. I've been a customer there myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
And still run by the family. I think it's Nick Scali's son Anthony that's currently the CEO, and they still own plenty of shares, so still very incentivized. Premier Investments have a couple of really strong brands as well.
Yeah,
Smiggle and Peter Alexander.
Yep.
And probably also one of the best retailers in the world in Solomon Lew.
Yep.
At least in Australia, I should say.
Yeah.
The last example, probably not as strong a brand, but still a very good retailer, is Lovisa.
Yeah. That's run by, Brett Blundy.
Yes.
Who's another very good, great, like a veteran of retail in Australia.
Yes, exactly. And so there are the retailer listed space is currently very cheap.
Yeah.
You can get some for around 10 times earnings. Lovisa is not quite as cheap because they do have a bit more of a growth path ahead of them, rolling out stores across the world. But it's a space that looks quite interesting.
Which is interesting, right, in itself, because we're talking about retailers exactly the same time people are talking about recession.
Yes.
You know, but the numbers seem to suggest that people are still spending.
That's right. Retail sales was up 19% on last year's admittedly depressed retail spending level. But people are still spending all the cash that they've been hoarding over the pandemic.
Yeah. Even here in Noosa, you see it down the street. Yeah. Every retailer, every shop is asking for staff, and you only take on staff if you're making money. So obviously this is a bit more on the nose for employment with like backpackers and all that sort of stuff, but really interesting nonetheless. Okay, so SaaS retailers, very different. High margin, low margin. What's the third one?
Third one is online platforms. So I do still like a good old-fashioned online platform. And what I'm talking about there is businesses that bring together a buyer and a seller and create a marketplace for them. So, for example, CarSalesSeek, REA.com, all really good examples in the Australian market. And what tends to happen there is the first mover tends to have the advantage, and it becomes a winner-takes-most market. And I'm just talking about the business model here. You can have your own views on the valuation and the attractiveness of those businesses in the market. But as a business model, I think they're still excellent.
And I think that's I was looking at car sales recently with Trader Interactive, their expansion into the RV and power sports market in the US. Really interesting. Seek is obviously doing different things. Obviously in China, but also with their growth fund. I think, yeah, it's really interesting because a lot of people, when they think about platforms, they think about, like, say, Facebook's dying or something like this. They think there's too many ads. But when you control the ecosystem, it's very valuable. You have a lot of strings that you can pull on the way up and on the way down.
That's right.
You can increase prices. You can increase ad count. You can reduce ad count. And there's no shortage of businesses in the world wanting customers. So if you control the ecosystem,
and if you can connect someone to their customers,
they're winning. So as long as they keep winning, then that's all you need to worry about, really. I really like that. So we've gone from SaaS, retail, and platforms, and you've given us some examples to go along with it. There is one final question before I let you get back to the conference, Luke. So thanks for spending some time with me here. Is a question we spoke about last night, which is, like, who are the investors that you look to, you have learned from or admired over time, over the course of your career?
Yeah. So I'll get Warren Buffett out of the way really quickly. So we've talked about him plenty, but basically learning from him through his letters and people writing about him, there's 2001 books written about Warren Buffett.
Is that right? So, it's 2001.
No, I made that up. Okay. But there's plenty of them.
I took that literally. So good.
But yeah, basically what I learned from him is buy quality businesses and try not to overpay.
Yep.
But the other thing that he talks about a lot, which investors don't tend to focus on as much, is making sure businesses that you invest in have a higher return on invested capital than their weighted average cost of capital, which sounds really technical, but essentially, just to explain that, a little bit, the capital in a business is what investors have put in there to run the business, which is either like investors holding shares or debt holders. Mm-hmm. There's a cost that comes along with that. With debt, it's really easy. It's just whatever the market price of the debt is or the interest rate is. It's a little bit more difficult on the for equity holders, but it's essentially an opportunity cost. So all that to say, there is a cost of the capital that goes into the business, and you want whatever return that the business is earning from that investment to be higher than that. And if it's not, the share price is probably going to go nowhere. So anyway, second one, I've learned a lot from Howard Marks over the years, but particularly his lessons on like everything is a cycle, particularly in the economy, particularly in investment markets. You'll see it swing. It's like a pendulum. There is an equilibrium, and it'll swing and it'll hit an equilibrium and it'll just go right on through. And so we're sort of seeing that at the moment. It's been a tremendous bull run, which has been great for investors. And then now this year, 2022, we've seen that swinging.
Back the other way.
That's right. And so you really don't see it turn until that that last investor sells or that last investor buys, and then there's no more buyers. And so there's a lot of fear in the market at the moment. I saw a chart this morning. The fear and greed index is bumping up against on the fear end of the scale at the moment, and so that will turn eventually. Don't ask me when it will be, but yeah, everything's a pendulum.
Yep, I like it. Yeah. So you've gone from Buffett to Howard Marks, probably two of the biggest names in the business, maybe alongside Ray Dalio, but. Yeah, I like it. Yeah. I need to read more of Howard Marks.
Maybe. Yeah, he's got two really good books, which I think I talked about with Raymond last time. Both worth a read.
Mm, I like it.
And the last one, I'm glad I didn't pick Ray Dalio for this last one. Michael Malbison, who he's an academic and he speaks very academically, is what I mean by that. And so some of his stuff is fairly high level. But the one investment lesson I've taken from him is all about expectations in markets. So you can do all the forecasts that you like, but and you'll come up with a forecast for a business. But everyone else is doing that as well. And I talked about at the beginning that the market is already forecasting cash flows into the future and discounting those back to find a price. If everyone knows that a business is going to increase at 20% per year for the next 10 years, then they're going to price that accordingly. And there's no margin there for you to have an edge. You need to understand those expectations first, come up with your own expectations and see where they differ. Then you can start to come up with a different opinion to the market. And make investing decisions accordingly. So it's very easy to identify a high quality company. Like anyone can do that. The hardest thing is coming up with that valuation that's actually different to what the market is seeing.
I think that's really apt, really succinct. Like when you talked about TouchCorp before, you come up with your own. It wasn't necessarily discounted cash flow analysis. You could look at the balance sheet and be like, they got this many shares of Afterpay, but Afterpay's worth this, so this is worth a lot. But then it's having the conviction to back those
ideas.
That's
right.
You know, and that's I think where it comes with a bit of experience. Now you can look back on that and you can think, okay, the market is clearly doing this. I'm being contrarian. I know that because this is my valuation. But I'm okay with that. And you have to kind of own that.
That's right.
And I think a lot of people do tend to struggle with that at times. I know I do. And what do you use? So just one final little thing in here. How do you get a sense of what the market is thinking? Are there any heuristics that you follow?
Yeah, so that's a great question because he talks about that in his book, Expectations Investing. So he does talk about a discounted cash flow model, but he flips it on its head. So he'll do his forecast and he'll have his discount rate that he's assuming that the market is using, and then he'll say, okay, well, how many years of profits or cash flows is the market actually forecasting for? So it might be 10 years is the DCF model that the market is implying. And then you can sort of use that in your own process.
I like it. Yeah. So one of the things that I learned pretty early on is the value in reversing a DCF.
Yes.
I haven't read the book, unfortunately, but I remember doing that with PayPal back in the day and thinking like, it was a very simple model of the number of users and revenue per user to get to, you know, multiple of revenue and then down to free cash flow. I remember looking at that and thinking, instead of me trying to pick what price target I should have for PayPal, it's easier just to set the valuation at the stock price and then understand what needs to go backwards from that.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. And that was interesting because like I could see at the time, I think it was the market was forecasting, like I think it was like 7% growth in revenue or something at the time. I was looking at this, I was like, this thing's going to grow a lot faster. Like you look at the industry, it's growing fast. It's also a gorilla. So it's going to take more share. That was the idea on the way up, and then it subsequently fell. So write it up and write it down. But mate, this has been heaps of fun. So you've brought some really good company examples to the table. So lessons learned over your journey. And you know, you've been doing this a while, so I really appreciate that that you can take some time out of the conference here. If people want to follow you on Twitter, what's your Twitter handle?
So you can find me at Luke Durbin.
Yep.
Just super simple.
Luke Durbin. Yep. And I'll put the link to that in the show notes.
Very good.
And then on the website too, if people want to find out, where do they go?
So our website is oracleim.com.au.
Simple. Yep. I like it. And if you click on the investment management tab in the top menu there, you'll see all the different funds and you'll be able to see letters and those types of things. So, Luke, thanks for taking some time to join me on the show.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Owen.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Before you go, I wanted to share some things with you. Specifically, I wanted to tell you about the 10 ways that Rask could help you in 2024. As many of you know, Rask has grown to become one of the biggest investing and finance platforms in Australia. Across our podcasts, our websites, our memberships, and so on, we now engage around 200,000 Aussies. Which, considering we started in a humble lounge room on a Kmart desk, one of those old fake white wooden ones, I'm pretty ecstatic about where we are 6 years later. As part of becoming one of Australia's biggest platforms for wealth creation and preservation, we now have a very special position in the country in that we can bring you some of the best, most thoughtful, expert-driven ways to protect and grow your wealth. And I'm going to share some of those with you now. I've got 10 ways that we can potentially help you or match you with someone who can. The first thing that I want to tell you about is the biggest step we've ever taken at Rask, which is the launch of our Rask Invest platform. This is a platform that lets our team, led by me, invest for you, primarily through low-cost, diversified ETFs. We'll have three strategies at launch, and every investor who comes through can pick one of the three strategies, being a balanced strategy, a growth strategy, and a high growth strategy. The balanced strategy focuses on passive income, and the high growth strategy focuses on longer term compounding. You will find a link in your podcast player to register your interest. We will be taking off soon. Number two, if you prefer to DIY your investing, you can join me and over 4,000 members inside Rask Core. That's our full ETF and ASX share research membership community. You can join now and you'll get updated ETF portfolio recommendations every quarter, as well as ongoing ASX and global stock research. Every single month, we call them the All-Star Stocks. You get that alongside the ETF portfolios, as well as other members-only content. It's called Rask Core. Number three, our first ever partnership with a business other than our own was a business by the name of Blusk, which has since become Flint Group. Flint Group is led by Chris Bates and Christian Stevens, two of Australia's most highly regarded mortgage brokers. Already over 200 Rask community members have begun the Rask plus Flint Group mortgage broking process. You can click the link in your podcast player if you're refinancing, investing, a first home buyer, or whatever. You've probably heard Chris on the show many times. Number four, you can connect with our most trusted financial advisors. Whether you're 25 years old, just graduated uni and looking to set yourself up, or approaching or in retirement and you've got that nest egg you want to protect and generate a passive income from, you can get in contact with our trusted panel of financial advisors. You can find the link in your podcast player. It's there each and every week. Just click the thing that says financial planning. Number five, if you want specialist insurance advice, as Warren Buffett said, rule number one is don't lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Insurance is vitally important, especially when it comes to your number one asset, you. Whether you're a single income household or a couple, and you just want to protect what would happen if, you want to protect your family if something goes wrong, you want to protect your spouse if you lose your job, you want to protect yourself if you hurt yourself on the weekend at footy, insurance is a way to do that. And I think the best way to do insurance is through a financial planner. And there's a few reasons for that. But one of them is sometimes some insurers will only work with financial advisors, but they can also be your companion as you go through the sometimes daunting process of getting insurance done properly. Sometimes you might not even know, but you're not even covered, even though you think you are. So get the right advice. You'll find a link in the show notes to check that out. Number six, buying property. If you're like me and you're thinking of buying property in the next 12 months, or maybe you've already invested and you're looking to downsize, getting the right advice and being able to build wealth through property is a proven strategy. It might be one of the most contentious, but I think that we have one of Australia's best property coaches in our ranks. That is Pete Wargent. Pete is the host of the now super popular Australian Property Podcast by Rask, and he's also my analyst team's macro consultant. So if you're a member of Rask Core, you will have seen Pete's name around the traps. He's a property coach and buyer's agent, and he works with a select number of people each and every year. Just a note on this. This is not a commercial thing with Pete. Pete just has great services, so we offer them to the community. And when he fills up, he fills up. You can find out more about Pete's coaching in the show notes. Next up, tracking your portfolio for tax. I think you are, because I think you have to. So we've partnered with Nivexa to help you manage your share and ETF reporting, whether it's tax or performance. All Rask users get 20% off an annual plan with Nivexa. You can sync your portfolio with Nivexa's software, and it automatically tracks your dividends, your capital gains tax, and more. Again, not a commercial partnership. We don't make anything from working with Nivexa, but they do create some great tools which the Rask community uses each and every day. Number eight, want to run your own business? Maybe you already do. If you want more profit, but less stress, less time consumed, and less energy lost, get in contact. We have a partner business called Inflection. The Inflection Accelerator Program is a complete online course that helps you and a community of members engage and follow a proven strategy for growing your business. I'm grateful to be one of the coaches inside the Accelerator program, helping business owners right across Australia. You can find more following the link in your podcast player. It's the one that says coaching. Number nine, if you haven't already checked it out, join over 20,000 other people who tune into the Rask YouTube channel. It is completely free and you get notified when we go live and when we publish podcast episodes. There is a podcast on the Rask network each and every day, as well as bite-sized material that's less than 60 seconds, or those really punchy tutorials and webinars that are just 15 minutes that take you through a really exciting topic, whether it's how to buy a property, whether it's how to pick a dividend ETF. Some of our most popular content actually just explains things like, what the heck is franking credits and how do I calculate if I've got some? That's on our YouTube channel. Number 10, if you want to be a better investor, a saver, a better partner with money, or just understand your own relationship with money, you can do that. All of that by going to the Rask Education website and taking a free course. We've enrolled over 26,000 students at the time of this recording, and we are on a mission to get to 100,000 in the next few years. Rask Education is our mostly free education platform, covering everything from budgeting and automation to the probably, I would say, the best value investing program in the country. So whether you're a value investor, an intermediate investor, you want to know how to value Woolworths shares, or you simply just want to understand what ethical investing is, or buy your first property and what actually happens on settlement day, head to the Rask Education website and enroll in something today. It is free and it supports us, because then I can come on here next month and I can say we've got 27,000, and hopefully we reach critical mass where we can help more Australians manage their money better. Thank you for listening to this long-winded ad. If you want to get in contact with me, you know where to go. There's a link in your show notes. Basically, these 10 services, even though some of them we don't make any money from, support Rask and allow us to produce these podcasts, attract the biggest and best guests from Australia and around the world, and bring them to you to answer your questions. Thank you for being part of the Rask network, and thank you for your ongoing support. Bye for now.